Sea Grant and Lake Superior, sustaining the freshwater sea. A production of the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. Satellites, detectives, and land intensity. Sleuthing the watershed for a sustainable future. The previous episode ended with our underwater archaeologists diving back into the depths of Lake Superior to investigate more historic shipwrecks. Now we are heading to the cold reaches outside the Earth's atmosphere, far above the Great Lakes. Patiently circling in geosynchronous orbit around the planet, remote sensing satellites have been providing a continuous stream of fascinating images and valuable information about the Earth's surface since 1972, when the first Landsat satellite was launched by NASA. The subsequent explosion of global-scale remote sensing research continues today, now fed by a multitude of government and commercial satellites. The striking beauty, size, and dynamic character of the Great Lakes make them a favorite subject for satellite imaging, and a quick search on the web will yield you many detailed and entrancing perspectives of the Great Lakes taken from near-Earth orbit. In 1975, NASA Administrator Dr. James Fletcher predicted that if one space-age development would save the world, it would be Landsat and its successor satellites. The information that these satellites gather is indeed a powerful tool for scientists at the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant who work on sustainability issues regarding the Great Lakes. For those tackling these real-world challenges, however, concepts like resiliency and adaptive management, the ability to successfully anticipate, cope with, and recover from environmental change, are often more productive than the sometimes fluid term sustainability, as its meaning can shift depending on who gets to decide what should be sustained. The unparalleled ability of remote sensing to assess changes in Earth's environment is being harnessed by researchers like David Hart and his graduate students here at Sea Grant in order to help public officials and local stakeholders form effective strategies for maintaining water resource quality and dealing with adverse environmental change. But this is only one part of forming an accurate picture of land use intensity around the Great Lakes. While satellites do provide detailed information about land cover, information about how the land is actually used is also obtained from planes using aerial photography and LIDAR, light detection and ranging sensors, that render detailed 3D images of specific areas. All this is being synthesized with existing public records into one comprehensive and updatable land intensity database, which can then be used as a tool for successful adaptive management of water resources. Right now, David's team is examining the watershed of the St. Louis estuary region on the western end of Lake Superior. I went to talk with David Hart first about the importance of this project.
I'm David Hart. I'm the Geographic Information Systems Specialist and Coastal Community Specialist at the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. I'm based in Madison, Wisconsin. I do work both on Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. One of the more interesting projects I have going on Lake Superior involves development of a coastal land intensity data set. For any type of ecological study, environmental management study that we have out there, we need information to be able to better understand the landscape, what's going on out there. Many different studies have a grand scope and have a grand data collection effort associated with it. A lot of money can go into that. And then we find out as we begin to understand the issue a little bit better, well, we missed the target. We shouldn't have collected this information. We should have collected this other data set. And then we start over again and spend more money on this. If we take more of an adaptive management approach, approach to this. We learn a little bit as we go along and we adjust our data collection. We find out, well, there's this data set that's missing. Let's see if we can't go out and find that. Let's work with existing people and try to make their data more shareable. I think that this idea of distributed custodians of data, custodians that are spread across the landscape in different jurisdictions, we can leverage their holdings instead of having to go out and start from scratch. We've got the potential to save money as we go along.
I asked David to give me some examples to see how this all plays out.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm going to talk about the difference between land use and land cover data. I'll start with land cover data. Typically, we've collected this type of information with satellites or maybe with airplanes passing over and scanning the Earth's surface, measuring things in equal-sized 30-meter by 30-meter grid cells across the landscape. We measure back some sort of reflectance of the Earth's surface. We can look at that and say this reflects a dense urban setting or a pine forest or a deciduous forest or perhaps a river or water body or so on. It covers the entire Earth's surface, but it's kind of what we're measuring, the observable characteristics of the Earth. When we get to land use, we're really looking at how individual property owners use the land, what kind of activity, what kind of economic function they're undertaking. And we can look at that at a variety of different scales, but the typical place that that takes place is individual property boundaries, parcels, cadastral information. Typically, across a particular parcel, it's used in a consistent way. So this particular parcel is being used for residential purposes, or it's being used for commercial purposes, it's being used for industry, and you can break that down to finer details. What kind of industry? Maybe it's meat packing, or maybe it's a port facility. You can go down to great levels of detail. And with this new land-based classification standards, we can look at this from multiple different dimensions. I think a great example is the Oscar Mayer plant that everybody in Madison drives by when they come back from the airport. That particular economic function is manufacturing meat, but there's lots of different activities that go on that land. There's a parking lot, there's office buildings, there's industrial facilities, there's a little union hall there, and so on. With this new way of classifying, we don't have to just say, oh, this is a mixed use. There's a lot of different things going on here, and we don't characterize it. Instead, we go into detail and capture each one of those activities, and we have a deeper understanding of what's happening on that land surface. Again, the two things go together, the land cover and the land use. For example, the satellite may pick up that there's a lot of asphalt on a surface. We may characterize that as high-intensity urban development. What we may be picking up is a vacant shopping center. The land use activity would pick up that that particular shopping center is vacant. Might not be a lot of cars in there and passing over it. Instead, when rain falls on that particular surface, we may pick up some heat from that, but there's not a lot of auto exhaust perhaps coming out of it, auto droppings, because it's not being used a lot. Whereas a similar type of surface that has a lot of commercial activity going on in that area would have a lot of cars going back and forth and lots of stuff coming off the cars, and it might have a different signature. Both of them, again, from the land cover perspective, you get this idea that there's something there. There's a lot of impervious surface, a lot of concrete and asphalt, but the land use side of things picks up how it's really being used, and that tells us a lot as well.
That explained the idea of land intensity fairly well to me, but I wanted to see how the work was actually being done. So I walked across the hall to the office where the graduate students are working up the data. Okay, I'm here in the offices of Sea Grant, where they are getting all the GIS information from satellite and analyzing it. The sleek office reminds you of perhaps the command center for Battlestar Galactica, or the deck of the Starship Enterprise, if it wasn't for the floor-to-ceiling 12-foot glass windows. Look out on, oh, who are we kidding? This is a public university. It's just a little office, and we're here talking with Sarah Wilkins. She's a graduate student with Sea Grant, and she's going to tell us about how she assists David Hart in his project.
Yeah, I'm working with David Hart on a project investigating coastal land use intensity. What we're doing is focusing on using a new method to acquire and analyze land use. We are using a methodology that was developed by the American Planning Association, known as the Land-Based Classification Standards. We're going through and looking at parcels up in the St. Louis River estuary, the border of Wisconsin and Minnesota, Superior, Wisconsin, and Duluth, Minnesota. The St. Louis River flows between the two states and into Lake Superior, that area has had quite a bit of degradation and industrial pollution from the industries that were there historically. And there's a lot of interest to clean up the estuary and to maintain the economic viability while also restoring critical habitat for fish, restoring water quality, and recreational opportunities for people in the area. So there's a lot of interest from stakeholders. It's a bi-state resource, and people are coming together to look at land uses and how they impact the quality, the ecological outcomes that we see throughout the estuary. What we're doing is we are walking through on a parcel-by-parcel level and identifying five different dimensions of land use. So instead of just defining land use as residential or industrial, we're actually going deeper, and we're identifying an activity, which is the physical activity, what's taking place in the landscape, the function, so the economic function of the landscape. So it might be used for railroad shipping, or it might be a dry cleaners. It could be any number of things. And then we're also looking at the structural characteristic, so the physical building that's on the property, ownership characteristic, who owns the property, and then also we're looking at the site development characteristics. So is it developing, or has it been developed, or is it vacant natural area? We're picking up all of this information, and I have been assisting David with walking through, looking at aerial photos, using a Polk directory, which allows us to look at addresses and ownership of properties. I've also been consulting land use maps that counties and planning commissions have developed and looking at those and any existing information I can find. I'm basically doing detective work for each parcel that touches the estuary is where we've started with this. So I've collected data in a spreadsheet in Excel for close to 1,400 parcels, which is quite a few. It can be quite tedious at times, but we're trying to test this methodology and see how effective it is and, you know, how much time it takes to actually conduct one of these surveys and if it will be useful for people in the region, primarily stakeholders.
I can see an aerial photograph of, looks like Superior. What are you looking at right here? Could you describe it?
Sure. So this is the city of Superior, Wisconsin. As you can see, there's some natural areas down towards the dam as you move up the estuary. And then as you move closer to the mouth of the estuary, you notice that the land intensity and the land use changes quite a bit. That's due to residential and also a lot of mostly industrial uses just along the harbor. And as you can notice, there's a lot of areas along the shore that have been built and manipulated to allow for ships to move in and out to collect coal or grain, limestone, timber, and other bulk goods that are moved throughout the port and through the region.
What's your background? How'd you get involved with this project?
I came to the University of Wisconsin looking to dive into a little bit more GIS work. I have a lot of interest in community-based conservation and how that influences outcomes, you know, both policy outcomes and on-the-ground conservation actions, how collaboration works. And this gave me an opportunity to get to know GIS a bit better and also down the line, hopefully be able to work with partners and stakeholders in the region to make this applicable and usable to them as practitioners and people trying to restore the estuary, which has been identified as an area of concern throughout the Great Lakes, which is something I probably should have mentioned before, but it's an area of concern due to the historical legacy contamination.
The listener should note that an area of concern is an official designation used by the Environmental Protection Agency. Areas of concern were formalized by the United States-Canada Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement in 1987 and are defined essentially as Sarah just described. Perhaps nothing is more essential for maintaining the ecological health of the Great Lakes than the goodwill and commitment of the governments and citizenry of the United States and Canada. One only has to look at the contaminated desert in Central Asia that was once the Aral Sea to know that these efforts are not to be taken lightly or for granted. I asked Sarah to tell me more about her previous conservation work.
I come to Sea Grant with quite an extensive background in water resources management and interests in freshwater conservation. So my background, I've done salt marsh research, I've done stream restoration work out west, I've done a lot of environmental education and groundwater research. I did some lake monitoring for a while. I very much have an interest in water, how we manage it and how we protect habitat.
What degree are you working on when you get all done?
I'm working towards a master's in conservation biology and sustainable development.
Is GIS hard? It looks hard.
It is. You know, I have some background. I did my undergraduate at the University of Vermont out east, and I did take a course in it, and I've used it on and off throughout my career. But it is, you know, especially with the new versions coming out, there are a lot of new tools and model analysis that you can do that I'm still familiarizing myself with. So it can be challenging, but it's also has a very friendly user face. Once I can get a hold of how to use these things, it's typically pretty easy to learn.
What jumps out at you when you look at Superior? You've looked at other areas. Is there anything unusual or something that has been on your mind as you look through all this data?
One thing that's really stood out to me that's fascinating is looking at the dredging history of the port. In order to allow for these large cargo ships to move in and out of the port, they've had to dredge the channels, and they have to do something with this dredge material. So when I initially started doing this LBCS survey, it was very interesting to see how engineers manipulated the port and built up some of these terminals. And they actually used a lot of the dredge spoils. These big ships would come through and they pull up the sediment in the channel in order to allow for these ships to move in and out. And then they have to do something with it. So some of the areas in Superior, some of the islands, Barker's Island, for instance, they actually took dredge spoils and built that island. There's been some controversy there regarding the use of the island because a lot of people think it should have a coastal dependent use. And this is something we're talking about, is that industry and economics in the region, they very much depend on the port to be able to move things by ship. And there's a lot of arguments saying that moving things by ship is much more economically feasible and more efficient than moving things by rail. So when a marina and other recreational facilities started moving in on the island, people were like, wait, shouldn't we be concentrating our coastal dependent uses here instead of these more recreational uses? It's very interesting to uncover some of those tensions that exist in the region, I guess. So that's one thing that I've picked up on as I've talked to people in Superior and in Duluth. But yeah, the dredging issue is still a major issue for the port. They are running out of space to dump the dredge material and to treat it. And so they've actually started recycling it. And they have a facility, it's called Erie Pier, and they bring the sediment there and they let it settle out through a series of ponds that they hold it in. And then they can use it actually in habitat enhancement to rebuild shoreline and help stabilize aquatic vegetation. So it's very interesting to see these sort of transformations.
You have 1,400 parcels to go through?
The intention initially was to capture the whole watershed, but that would take quite a bit of time. And so we're thinking about how we could possibly make this more systematic and maybe develop some way that we can more easily capture this information for the LBCS survey. We just restricted the land-based classification standard survey to these 1,400 parcels, so any parcel that is touching the water. Right now, I'm doing a little bit of tweaking of the data because we have some data issues with Duluth that we need to work out currently.
So are you on parcel 12?
No, I'm way past parcel number 12. No, I'm doing all right. I'm moving along. So it can be tedious at times, but this is something that we're sort of uncovering as we do this, is that it's time intensive.
But you have to be methodical to be a good detective, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you do. Yeah. So it's been sort of interesting because and David has been talking to me a lot about this, is that I've come to very intimately know the parcels around the harbor. And so when I was up there last, I was driving around and I go, oh yeah, I know what that parcel is and who owns that and what the activity and economic use of this parcel is. So yeah, I've become acquainted with it quite a bit. So that's interesting.
Okay, well, I'll let you get back to GIS detective work and we will talk to you soon.
All right, thanks.
In 1967, Richard Brautigan wrote a celebrated poem imagining a cybernetic ecology in a utopian future titled All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. 45 years later, we are indeed all watched over by graceful machines, but it is the tireless dedication of Sea Grant researchers like David Hart and Sarah Wilkins working with the data our machines provide that is making the goal of a sustainable ecology a reality for Lake Superior. Till next time.